This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963 by Christopher Paul Curtis. And you wonder why we get called the Weird Watsons. It was one of those super-duper cold Saturdays. One of those days that when you breathed out, your breath kind of hung frozen in the air like a hunk of smoke, and you could walk along and look exactly like a train blowing out big, fat, white puffs of smoke. It was so cold that if you were stupid enough to go outside, your eyes would automatically blink 1,000 times all by themselves, probably so the juice inside of them wouldn't freeze up. It was so cold that if you spit, the slob would be an ice cube before it hit the ground. It was about a zillion degrees below zero. It was even cold inside our house. We put sweaters and hats and scarves and 3 pairs of socks on and still were cold. The thermostat was turned all the way up and the furnace was banging and sounding like it was about to blow up, but it still felt like Jack Frost had moved in with us. All of my family sat real close together on the couch under a blanket. Dad said this would generate a little heat, but he didn't have to tell us this. It seemed like the cold automatically made us want to get together and huddle up. My little sister, Joetta, sat in the middle, and all you could see were her eyes because she had a scarf wrapped around her head. I was next to her, and on the outside was my mother. Mama was the only one who wasn't born in Flint, so the cold was coldest to her. All you could see were her eyes, too, and they were shooting bad looks at Dad. She always blamed him for bringing her all the way from Alabama to Michigan, a state she called a giant icebox. Dad was bundled up on the other side of Joey, trying to look at anything but Mama. Next to Dad, sitting with a little space between them, was my older brother, Byron. Byron had just turned 13, so he was officially a teenage juvenile delinquent and didn't think it was cool to touch anybody or let anyone touch him, even if it meant he froze to death. Byron had tucked the blanket between him and Dad down into the cushion of the couch to make sure he couldn't be touched. Dad turned on the TV to try to make us forget how cold we were, but all that did was get him in trouble. There was a special news report on Channel 12 telling about how bad the weather was, and Dad groaned when the guy said, "If you think it's cold now, wait until tonight. The temperature is expected to drop into record low territory, possibly reaching the negative 20s. In fact, we won't be seeing anything above zero for the next 4 to 5 days." He was smiling when he said this, but none of the Watson family thought it was funny. We all looked over at Dad. He just shook his head and pulled the blanket over his eyes. Then the guy on TV said, "Here's a little something we can use to brighten our spirits and give us some hope for the future. The temperature in Atlanta, Georgia is forecast to reach..." Dad coughed real loud and jumped off the couch to turn the TV off, but we all heard the weatherman say, "The mid-70s. The guy might as well have tied Dad to a tree and said, "Ready, aim, fire." "Atlanta," Mama said, "that's 150 miles from home." "Winona," Dad said. "I knew it," Mama said. "I knew I should have listened to Moses Henderson." "Who?" I asked. Dad said, "Oh, Lord, not that sorry story. You've got to let me tell about what happened with him." Mama said, "There's not a whole lot to tell. Just a story about a young girl who made a bad choice. But if you do tell it, make sure you get all the facts right." We all huddled as close as we could get because we knew Dad was going to try to make us forget about being cold by cutting up. Me and Joey started smiling right away, and Byron tried to look cool and bored. "Kids," Dad said, "I almost wasn't your father. You guys came real close to having a clown for a daddy named Hambone Henderson." "Daniel Watson, you stop right there. You're the one who started that Hambone nonsense. Before you started that, everyone called him his Christian name, Moses. And he was a respectable boy, too. He wasn't a clown at all." But the name stuck, didn't it? Hambone Henderson. Me and your granddaddy called him that because the boy had a head shaped just like a ham bone, had more knots and bumps on his head than a dinosaur. So, as you guys sit here giving me these dirty looks because it's a little chilly outside, ask yourselves if you'd rather be a little cool or go through life being known as the Hambonettes. Me and Joey cracked up. Byron kind of chuckled, and Mama put her hand over her mouth. She did this whenever she was going to give a smile because she had a great big gap between her front teeth. If Mama thought something was funny, first you'd see her trying to keep her lips together to hide the gap. Then, if the smile got to be too strong, you'd see the gap for a hot second before Mama's hand would come up to cover it. Then she'd crack up too. Laughing only encouraged Dad to cut up more. So when he saw the whole family thinking he was funny, he really started putting on a show. He stood in front of the TV. Yup, Hambone Henderson proposed to your mother around the same time I did. Fought dirty, too. Told your mama a pack of lies about me, and when she didn't believe them, he told her a pack of lies about Flint. Dad started talking Southern style, imitating this Hambone guy. Willona, I heard tell about the weather up that far north in Flint, Michigan. Heard it's colder than inside a icebox. Seen a movie about it. Think it was made in Flint. Movie called Nanook of the North. Yep. Do believe for sure it was made in Flint. Flint, Michigan. Folks there live in these things called igloos. According to what I seen in this here movie, most of the folks in Flint is Chinese. Don't believe I seen nan one colored person in the whole dang city. You a Bama gal. Don't believe you be too happy living in no igloo. Ain't got nothing against them. But don't believe you'd be too happy living amongst a whole slew of Chinese folks. Don't believe you'd like the food. Only thing them Chinese folks in that movie ate was whales and seals. Don't believe you'd like no whale meat. Don't taste a lick like chicken. Don't taste like pork at all. Mama pulled her hand away from her mouth. Daniel Watson, you are one lying man. Only thing you said that was true was that being in Flint is like living in an igloo. I knew I should have listened to Moses. Maybe these babies might have been born with lumpy heads, but at least they'd have had warm, lumpy heads. You know Birmingham is a good place, and I don't mean just the weather either. The life is slower. The people are friendlier. Oh, yeah, Dad interrupted. They're a laugh a minute down there. Let's see, where was that coloreds only bathroom downtown? Daniel? You know what I mean. Things aren't perfect, but people are more honest about the way they feel. She took her mean eyes off Dad and put them on Byron. And folks there do know how to respect their parents. Byron rolled his eyes like he didn't care. All he did was tuck the blanket farther into the couch's cushion. Dad didn't like the direction the conversation was going, so he called the landlord for the 100th time. The phone was still busy. That snake in the grass has got his phone off the hook. Well, it's going to be too cold to stay here tonight. Let me call Sydney. She just had that new furnace put in. Maybe we can spend the night there. Aunt Sydney was kind of mean, but her house was always warm, so we kept our fingers crossed that she was home. Everyone, even Byron, cheered when Dad got Aunt Sydney and she told us to hurry over before we froze to death. Dad went out to try and get the Brown Bomber started. That was what we called our car. It was a 1948 Plymouth that was dull brown and real big. Byron said it was turd brown. Uncle Bud gave it to Dad when it was 13 years old, and we'd had it for 2 years. Me and Dad took real good care of it, but some of the time, it didn't like to start up in the winter. After 5 minutes, Dad came back in, huffing and puffing and slapping his arms across his chest. Well, it was touch and go for a while, but the great brown one pulled through again. Everyone cheered, but me and Byron quit cheering and started frowning right away. By the way Dad smiled at us, we knew what was coming next. Dad pulled two ice scrapers out of his pocket and said, "Okay, boys, let's get out there and knock those windows out." We moaned and groaned and put some more coats on and went outside to scrape the car's windows. I could tell by the way he was pouting that Byron was going to try and get out of doing his share of the work. "I'm not going to do your part, Byron. You'd better do it, and I'm not playing either." "Shut up, punk." I went over to the Brown Bomber's passenger side and started hacking away at the scab of ice that was all over the windows. I finished Mama's window and took a break. Scraping ice off of windows when it's that cold can kill you. I didn't hear any sound coming from the other side of the car, so I yelled out, "I'm serious, Byron! I'm not doing that side too, and I'm only gonna do half the windshield. I don't care what you do to me." The windshield on the bomber wasn't like the new 1963 cars. It had a big bar running down the middle of it, dividing it in half. "Shut your stupid mouth. I got something more important to do right now." I peeked around the back of the car to see what Bai was up to. The only thing he'd scraped off was the outside mirror, and he was bending down to look at himself in it. He saw me and said, "You know what, Square? I must be adopted. There just ain't no way two folks as ugly as your mama and daddy could have give birth to someone as sharp as me." He was running his hands over his head like he was brushing his hair. I said, "Forget you," and went back over to the other side of the car to finish the back window. I had half of the ice off when I had to stop again and catch my breath. I heard Byron mumble my name. I said, "You think I'm stupid? It's not gonna work this time." He mumbled my name again. It sounded like his mouth was full of something. I knew this was a trick. I knew this was going to be How to Survive a Blizzard Part 2. How to Survive a Blizzard Part 1 had been last night when I was outside playing in the snow and Byron and his running buddy, Bubhead, came walking by. Bubhead has officially been a juvenile delinquent even longer than Byron. "Say, kid," Bai had said, "you want to learn something that might save your stupid life one day?" I should have known better. But I was bored, and I think maybe the cold weather was making my brain slow, so I said, "What's that?" "We're going to teach you how to survive a blizzard." "How?" Byron put his hands in front of his face and said, "This is the most important thing to remember, okay?" "Why?" "Well, first we got to show you what it feels like to be trapped in a blizzard. You ready?" He whispered something to Bubhead, and they both laughed. "I'm ready." I should have known that the only reason Bubhead and Bai would want to play with me was to do something mean. "Okay," Bai said. "First thing you got to worry about is high winds." Byron and Bubhead each grabbed one of my arms and one of my legs and swung me between them, going, "Woo, blizzard warnings, blizzard warnings, woo, take cover." Bubhead counted to three, and on the third swing, they let me go in the air. I landed head first in a snowbank. But that was okay because I had on three coats, two sweaters, a t-shirt, three pairs of pants, and four socks, along with a scarf, a hat, and a hood. These guys couldn't have hurt me if they'd thrown me off the Empire State Building. After I climbed out of the snowbank, they started laughing, and so did I. "Cool, baby bruh," Bai said. "You passed that part of the test with a B+. What you think, Bubhead?" Bubhead said, "Yeah, I'd give the little punk a A." They whispered some more and started laughing again. "Okay," Bai said. "Second thing you gotta learn is how to keep your balance in a high wind. You gotta be good at this so you don't get blowed into no polar bear dens." They put me in between them and started making me spin round and round. It seemed like they spun me for about half an hour. When slob started flying out of my mouth, they let me stop, and I wobbled around for a while before they pushed me back in the same snowbank. When everything stopped going in circles, I got up, and we all laughed again. They whispered some more, and then Bai said, "What you think, Buphead? He kept his balance a good long time. I'm gonna give him a A-. I ain't as hard a grader as you. I'ma give the little punk a AA-. "Okay, Kenny. Now, the last part of surviving a blizzard. You ready?" "Yep." "You passed the wind test and did real good on the balance test, but now we gotta see if you're ready to graduate. You remember what we told you was the most important part about surviving?" "Yep." "Okay, here we go. Bubhead, tell him about the final exam." Bubhead turned me around to look at him, putting my back to Byron. "Okay, Square," he started. "I want to make sure you're ready for this one. You done so good so far, I want to make sure you don't blow it at graduation time. You think you ready?" I nodded, getting ready to be thrown in the snowbank real hard this time. I made up my mind I wasn't going to cry or anything. I made up my mind that no matter how hard they threw me in that snow, I was going to get up laughing. "Okay," Bubhead said. "Everything's cool. You remember what your brother said about putting your hands up? Like this?" I covered my face with my gloves. "Yeah, that's it." Bubhead looked over my shoulder at Byron and then said, Ooh, high winds, blowing snow. Ooh, look out, blizzard a coming, death around the corner, look out. Byron mumbled my name, and I turned around to see why his voice sounded so funny. As soon as I looked at him, Byron blasted me in the face with a mouth full of snow. Man, it was hard to believe how much stuff By could put in his mouth. Him and Bubhead just about died laughing as I stood there with snow and spit and ice dripping off of my face. Byron caught his breath and said, "Oh man, you flunked. You done so good, and then you go and flunk the blowing snow section of How to Survive a Blizzard. You forgot to put your hands up. What you say, Bubhead? F?" "Yeah, double F minus." It was a good thing my face was numb from the cold already, or I might have froze to death. I was too embarrassed about getting tricked to tell on them, so I went in the house and watched TV. So as me and By scraped the ice off the brown bomber, I wasn't going to get fooled again. I kept on chopping ice off the back window and ignored By's mumbling voice. The next time I took a little rest, Byron was still calling my name but sounding like he had something in his mouth. He was saying, "Hey, Kay, Hill, Hill." When he started banging on the door of the car, I went to take a peek at what was going on. By was leaned over the outside mirror looking at something in it real close. Big puffs of steam were coming out of the side of the mirror. I picked up a big, hard chunk of ice to get ready for Byron's trick.
"Kay! Kay! Help me! Help me! Go get Mama! Go get Mama! Hurry up!"
"I'm not playing, Byron. I'm not that stupid. You'd better start doing your side of the car, or I'll tear you up with this ice ball." He banged his hand against the car harder and started stomping his feet.
"Oh, please, Kay! Help me! Go get Mama!"
I raised the ice chunk over my head. "I'm not playing, By. You better get busy or I'm telling Dad." I moved closer, and when I got right next to him, I could see boogers running out of his nose and tears running down his cheeks. These weren't tears from the cold either. These were big, juicy crybaby tears. I dropped my ice chunk. "By, what's wrong?"
"Help me! Kay, go get her!"
I moved closer. I couldn't believe my eyes. Byron's mouth was frozen on the mirror. He was as stuck as a fly on flypaper. I could have done a lot of stuff to him. If it had been me with my lips stuck on something like this, he'd have tortured me for a couple of days before he got help. Not me, though. I nearly broke my neck trying to get into the house to rescue Byron. As soon as I ran through the front door, Mama, Dad, and Joey all yelled, "Close that door!" "Mama, quick! It's By! He's froze up outside!" No one seemed too impressed. I screamed, "Really? He's froze to the car! Help! He's crying!" That shook him up. You could cut Byron's head off and he probably wouldn't cry. "Kenneth Bernard Watson, what on earth are you talking about? Mama, please hurry up!" Mama, Dad, and Joey threw on some extra coats and followed me to the brown bomber. The fly was still stuck and buzzing.
"Oh, Mama, help me! Get me off of here!"
"Oh, my Lord!" Mama screamed, and I thought she was going to do one of those movie-style feints. She even put her hand over her forehead and staggered back a little bit. Joey, of course, started crying right along with Byron. Dad was doing his best not to explode laughing. Big puffs of smoke were coming out of his nose and mouth as he tried to squeeze his laughs down. Finally, he put his head on his arms and leaned against the car's hood and howled. "Byron," Mama said, gently wiping tears off his cheeks with the end of her scarf. "It's okay, sweetheart. How'd this happen?" She sounded like she was going to be crying in a minute herself. Dad raised his head and said, "Why are you asking how it happened? Can't you tell, Willona? This little knucklehead was kissing his reflection in the mirror and got his lips stuck." Dad took a real deep breath. "Is your tongue stuck, too?"
"No, quit teasing, Daddy. Hell, hell."
Well, at least the boy hadn't gotten too passionate with himself. Dad thought that was hilarious and put his head back on his arms. Mama didn't see anything funny. "Daniel Watson, what are we gonna do? What do y'all do when this happens up here?" Mama started talking Southern style when she got worried. Instead of saying "here," she said "here." And instead of saying "you all," she said "y'all." Dad stopped laughing long enough to say, "Willona, I've lived in Flint all my life, 35 years, and I swear this is the first time I've ever seen anyone with their lips frozen to a mirror. Honey, I don't know what to do. Wait till he thaws out? Pull him off, Dad, I suggested. Byron went nuts. He started banging his hands on the brown bomber's doors again and mumbling,
No, no, Mama, don't let him.
Joey blubbered out, This is just like that horrible story Kenny read me about that guy, Narcissi, who stared at himself so long he forgot to eat and starved to death. Mommy, please save him. She went over and hugged her arms around stupid Byron's waist. Mama asked Dad, What about hot water? Couldn't we pour enough hot water on the mirror so it would warm up and he could get off? She kept wiping tears off Bai's cheeks and said, Don't you worry, baby. We're gonna get you off of this. But her voice was so shaky and southern that I wondered if we'd be driving around in the summer with a skeleton dangling from the outside mirror by its lips. Dad said, I don't know. Pouring water on it might be the worst thing to do, but it might be our only chance. Why don't you go get some hot tap water and I'll stay to wipe his cheeks? Joey told Bai, Don't worry, we'll come right back. She stood on her tiptoes and gave Bai a kiss. Then she and Mama ran inside. Dad cracked up all over again. Well, lover boy, I guess this means no one can call you hot lips, can they? Dad was killing himself. Or the last of the red-hot lovers either, huh? He tugged on Byron's ear a little, pulling his face back. Bai went nuts again.
Don't do that! Mama! Mama, hell! Kay, go get Mama! Hurry!
I guess that's not going to work, is it? Every time he wiped away the tears and the little mustache of boogers on Byron's lip, Dad couldn't help laughing, until a little river of tears was coming out of his eyes, too. Dad tried to straighten his face out when Mama and Joey came running back with a steaming glass of hot water, but the tears were still running down his cheeks. Mama tried to pour water on the mirror, but her hands were shaking so much she was splashing it all over the place. Dad tried too, but he couldn't look at Byron without laughing and shaking. That meant I had to do it. I knew that if my lips were frozen on something and everybody was shaking too much to pour water on them except for Byron, he'd do some real cruel stuff to me. He probably would have accidentally splashed my eyes until they were frozen open or put water in my ears until I couldn't hear anything. But not me. I gently poured a little stream of water over the mirror. Dad was right. This was the worst thing we could do. The water made a cracking sound and froze solid as soon as it touched the mirror and Bai's lips. Maybe Bai's mouth was frozen, but his hands sure weren't, and he popped me right in the forehead. Hard. I hate to say it, but I started crying too. It's no wonder the neighbors called us the Weird Watsons behind our backs. There we were, all five of us standing around a car with the temperature about 1,000,000 degrees below zero, and each and every one of us crying.
Thump! Thump! Bai yelled.
Daniel Watson, what are we gonna do? Mama went nuts. You gotta get this boy to the hospital. My baby is gonna die. Dad tried to look serious real quick. Wilona, how far do you think I'd get driving down the street with this little clown attached to the mirror? What am I supposed to do? Have him run beside the car all the way down to the emergency room? Mama looked real close at Bai's mouth, closed her eyes for a second like she was praying, and finally said, Daniel, you get in there and call the hospital and see what they say we should do. Joey and Kenny, go with your daddy. Dad and Joey went crying into the house. I stayed by the brown bomber. I figured Mama was clearing everybody out for something. Byron did too and looked at Mama in a real nervous way. Mama put her scarf around Byron's face and said, Sweetheart, you know we gotta do something. I'ma try to warm your face up a little. Just relax.
Okay, Mama.
You know I love you and wouldn't do anything to hurt you, right? If Mama was trying to make Byron relax, she wasn't doing a real good job at it. All this talk about love and not getting hurt was making him real nervous.
What are you gonna do, huh? Don't hurt me. Kay, hell!
Mama moved the scarf away and put one hand on Byron's chin and the other one on his forehead.
No! Hell! Help me, Kay!
Mama gave Byron's head a good hard snatch, and my eyes automatically shut, and my hands automatically flew up to cover my ears, and my mouth automatically flew open and screamed out, "Yow!" I didn't see it, but I bet Byron's lips stretched a mile before they finally let go of that mirror. I bet his lips looked like a giant rubber band before they snapped away from that glass. I didn't hear it, but I bet Byron's lips made a sound like a giant piece of paper being ripped in half. When I opened my eyes, Byron was running to the house with his hands over his mouth and Mama following right behind him. I ran over to the mirror to see how much of Byron's mouth was still stuck there. The dirty dogs let Byron get away with not doing his share of the windows, and I had to do the whole car myself. When we were finally going to Aunt Sydney's house, I decided to pay Byron back for punching me in the forehead and getting out of doing his part of the window scraping. Joey was sitting between us, so I felt kind of safe. I said to her loud, "Joetta, guess what? I'm thinking about writing my own comic book." "What about?" "Well, it's going to be about this real mean criminal who has a terrible accident that turns him into a superhero." Joey knew I was going to tease Byron, so she sat there looking like I should be careful what I said. Finally, I asked her, "Do you want to know what I'm going to call this new superhero?" "What?" "I'm going to call him the Lipless Wonder. All he does is beat up superheroes smaller than him, and the only thing he's afraid of is a cold mirror." All the weird Watsons, except Byron, cracked up. Mama's hand even covered her mouth. I was the only one who saw Byron flip me a dirty finger sign and try to whisper without smearing all the Vaseline Mama had put on his lips, "You wait, I'm gonna kick your little behind." Then he made his eyes go crossed, which was his favorite way of teasing me, but I didn't care. I knew who had won this time. Give my regards to Clark, Poindexter. Larry Dunn was the king of the kindergarten to fourth grade where I went to school at Clark Elementary. He was king because he was a lot older than anyone else and twice as strong as the rest of us. He was stronger because he was almost full grown and he'd flunked some grade two or three times. He was the third oldest kid at Clark. The only ones older than him and stronger than him were Byron and Buphead, who were in the sixth grade and who'd also flunked some grade at least once. We weren't sure because it was something that Mama and Dad didn't talk about. Larry Dunn was king of the kindergarten to fourth grade only because Byron didn't care about them. Larry was the king of Clark, but Byron was a god. It seemed like that would make me a prince or a real strong angel or something, but it didn't work that way. I was just another fourth grade punk. I guess having the school's god as my brother did give me some kind of special rights, but not a whole bunch. It helped me with stupid stuff, like the time I found a dollar bill and got too excited and was crazy enough to show it to Larry Dunn. I knew this was a big mistake about a second before he stuck his hand out and said, "Let me see it." What could I do? "Kenny," he said, "where you find this buck?" "Outside the school over by Kenilworth." Larry turned my dollar over and over, and I started getting nervous. "You know what, Kenny?"
"What?"
I held my breath. "This is some real strange stuff, but I lost 50 cents over on Kenilworth yesterday, and I bet my 50 cents got hooked up with someone else's 50 cents and made this here buck." Whew! I let my breath go, smiled, and nodded. We went to the store to get change, and Larry Dunn got back the 50 cents he lost, and I got to keep the other 50 that got hooked up with Larry's. I knew if it wasn't for Byron being my big brother, Larry would have said something like, "Since my 50 cents found this other 50 cents and they hooked up to make this here buck, I'm gonna keep the whole thing. You know the rules, finders, keepers, losers, weepers." Having the school's god as my relative helped in some other ways, too. I had two things wrong with me that would have gotten me beat up and teased a lot more than I did if it hadn't been for Bi. The first thing was, because I loved to read, people thought I was real smart, teachers especially. Teachers started treating me different than other kids when I was in the first grade. At first, I thought it was cool for them to think I was smart, but then I found out it made me enemies with some of the other kids. Back when I was in the second grade, Miss Henry used to take me to different classrooms and have me read stuff out of the Bible or the newspaper in front of other kids. This was a lot of fun, until I started looking up from what I was reading and noticed that while Miss Henry and the other teachers were smiling a mile a minute, all the kids had their faces twisted up or were looking at me like I was a six-legged dog. 2 years ago, Miss Henry took me to Mr. Allams's fifth grade class. Mr. Allams was the toughest teacher in the school, and just being in front of him was kind of scary. He looked down at me and said, "Good morning, Mr. Watson. I hope you are in good form today." I just nodded at him because I wasn't sure what that meant. "Don't be nervous, Kenny," Miss Henry said. "Mr. Allams would like you to read a few passages from Langston Hughes." She handed me a book and said, "You wait here while we introduce you to the class." Man, some of the time I wished I was as smart as these teachers thought I was, because if I had been, I would have dropped that book and run all the way home. If I'd been smart enough to figure out what was going to happen next, I would have never gone into that room. I stood in the hall, looking at the stuff they wanted me to read, while Mr. Allams told his class, "All right, I have a special treat for you today. I have often told you that as Negroes, the world is many times a hostile place for us." I saw Mr. Allams walking back and forth, whacking a yardstick in his hand. "I've pointed out time and time again how vital it is that one be able to read well. I've stressed on numerous occasions the importance of being familiar and comfortable with literature. Today, Miss Henry and I would like to give you a demonstration of your own possibilities in this regard. I want you to carefully note how advanced this second grade student is, and I particularly want you to be aware of the effect his skills have upon you. I want you to be aware that some of our kids read at miraculous levels." I saw Mr. Allams point the yardstick at someone somewhere in the class and say, "Perhaps you'd like to finish the introduction. I think you know our guest quite well." Whoever he pointed at said, "What? I didn't do nothing." Miss Henry waved for me to come in and stand in front of the class. I guess I was too nervous about Mr. Allams to have recognized the voice before, but as soon as I walked into the room, I froze. There, in the two seats closest to the teacher's desk, in the very first row, sat Buphead and Byron. The Langston Hughes book jumped from my hand and the whole class laughed, everyone but Byron. His eyes locked on mine, and I felt things start melting inside of me. Mr. Allams slammed the yardstick on his desk, and the class got real, real quiet. "Let's see if you find this so humorous after you've heard how well this young man reads. And Byron Watson, if you are incapable of taking some of the fire out of your eyes, I assure you I will find a way to assist you. If, instead of trying to intimidate your young brother, you would emulate him and use that mind of yours, perhaps you'd find things much easier. Perhaps you wouldn't be making another appearance in the fifth grade next year. Now would you, Byron got one more dirty look in at me, then looked down at his desk. Mr. Allams might as well have tied me up to a pole and said, "Ready, aim, fire." I read through the Langston Hughes stuff real quick, but that was a mistake. Miss Henry said, "Slow down some, Kenneth." And then she took the book from me and handed it back upside down. She had a great big smile when she told Mr. Allams, "When he goes too fast, this slows him down a bit." I read some more with the book upside down and got some real strange looks from the fifth graders. Finally, they let me quit. Mr. Allams stood up and clapped his hands, and a couple of the old kids did too. Byron never looked at me the whole time, but Buphead was giving me enough dirty looks for both of them. "Bravo! Outstanding, Mr. Watson! Your future is unlimited! Bravo!" All I could do was try to figure out how to get home alive. I didn't even get out of the schoolyard before Byron and Buphead caught up to me. A little crowd bunched up around us, and everyone was real excited because they knew I was about to get jacked up. Buphead said, "Hear that little egghead punk is? Leave the little clown alone, Byron said. It's a crying shame taking him around like a circus freak. He punched me kind of soft in the arm and said, at least you ought to make them pay you for doing that mess. If it was me, they'd be coming out their pockets with some folding money every time they took me around. I couldn't believe it. I think Byron was proud of me. When everybody saw Byron wasn't going to do anything to me for being smart, they all decided that they better not do anything either. I still got called Egghead or Poindexter, Professor some of the time, but that wasn't bad compared to what could have happened. The other thing that people would have teased me a lot more about if it hadn't been for Byron was my eye. Mama said it wasn't important, that I was a real handsome little boy, but ever since I'd been born, one of my eyeballs had been kind of lazy. That means instead of looking where I tell it to look, it wanted to rest in the corner of my eye next to my nose. I'd done lots of things to make it better, but none of them worked. I'd done exercises where I had to look that way, then this way, then that way, up and down, down and up. But when I went to look in the mirror, the eye still went back to its corner. I'd worn a patch on my other eye to make the lazy one work, but that didn't do anything either. It was fun to play like I was a pirate for a while, but that got boring. Finally, Byron gave me some good advice. He noticed that when I talked to people, I squinched my lazy eye kind of shut or that I'd put my hand on my face to cover it. I only did this because it got hard to talk to someone when they were staring at your eye instead of listening to what you had to say. Look, man, he told me, if you don't want people to look at your messed up eye, you just gotta do this. Byron made me stand still and look straight ahead. Then he stood on my side and told me to look at him. I turned my head to look. Nah, man, keep your head straight and look at me sideways. I did it. See? You ain't cockeyed no more. Your eye's as straight as an arrow now. I went to the bathroom, stood on the toilet, and leaned over to look in the mirror sideways, and Byron was right. I couldn't help smiling. Mama was right, too. I was a kind of handsome little guy when I looked at myself sideways, and both eyes were pointing in the same direction. Even though my older brother was Clark Elementary School's god, that didn't mean I never got teased or beat up at all. I still had to fight a lot and still got called Cockeye Kenny, and I still had people stare at my eye, and I still had to watch when they made their eyes go cross when they were teasing me. It seemed like one of these things happened to me every day, but if it hadn't been for Byron, I knew they'd have happened a whole lot more. That's why I was kind of nervous about what was going to happen if Byron ever got out of sixth grade and went to junior high school before I caught up to him. That's why I was going to send off for that book, Learn Karate in 3 Weeks, that was in the back of my comic books. The worst part about being teased was riding the school bus on those mornings when Byron and Bubhead decided they were going to skip school. We'd be standing on the corner waiting for the bus. Byron, Bubhead, and all the other old thugs in one bunch, Larry Dunn, Banky, and all the other young thugs in another bunch, the regular kids like Joetta in a third bunch, and me off to the side by myself. When we saw the bus about 3 blocks away, we all got in a line. Old thugs, young thugs, regular kids, then me. It wasn't until the bus stopped and the door opened that I knew whether Bi and Bubhead were going. I hated it when Bi walked past and said, "Give my regards to Clark, Poindexter." Some of the time, those words were like a signal for the other kids to jump on me. But the day I stopped hating the bus so much began with those same words. We were all lined up. "Give my regards to Clark, Poindexter," Bi said, and disappeared around the bus's back. I got on the bus and took the seat right behind the driver. The days Bi rode, I would sit a few rows from him in the back. On other days, the driver was the most protection. The bus drove down into public housing, and after everyone was picked up, we headed toward Clark. But today, the bus driver did something he'd never done before. He noticed 2 kids running up late, and he stopped to let them get on. Every other time someone was late, he'd just laugh at them and tell the rest of us, "This is the only way you little punks is gonna learn to be punctual. I hope that fool has a pleasant walk to school." Then, no matter how hard the kid banged on the side of the bus, the driver would just take off, laughing out of the window. That was part 1 of my miracle that let me know something special was going to happen. As soon as the doors of the bus swung open and two strange new boys got on, part two of my miracle happened. Every once in a while, Mama would make me go to Sunday school with Joey. Even though it was just a bunch of singing and coloring books and listening to Mrs. Davidson, I had learned one thing. I learned about getting saved. I learned how someone could come to you when you were feeling real, real bad and could take all of your problems away and make you feel better. I learned that the person who saved you, your personal saver, was sent by God to protect you and to help you out. When the bigger one of the two boys who got on the bus late said to the driver in a real down-south accent, "Thank you for stopping, sir," I knew right away. I knew that God had finally gotten sick of me being teased and picked on all the time. As I looked at this new boy with the great big smile and the jacket with holes in the sleeves and the raggedy tennis shoes and the tore-up blue jeans, I knew who he was. Maybe he didn't live a million years ago, and maybe he didn't have a beard and long hair, and maybe he wasn't born under a star, but I knew anyway. I knew God had finally sent me some help. I knew God had finally sent me my personal saver. As soon as the boy thanked the driver in that real polite, real country way, I jerked around in my seat to see what the other kids were going to do to him. Whenever someone new started coming to Clark, most of the kids took some time to see what he was like. The boys would see if he was tough or weak, if he was cool or a square, and the girls would look to see if he was cute or ugly. Then they decided how to treat him. I knew they weren't going to waste any time with this new guy. It was going to be real easy and real quick with him. He was like nobody we'd seen before. He was raggedy. He was country. He was skinny and he was smiling at everybody a mile a minute. The boy with him had to be his little brother. He looked like a shrunk-up version of the big one. Everyone had stopped what they were doing and were real quiet. Some were standing up to get a better look. The older one got an even bigger smile on his face and waved real hard at everybody. The little shrunk-up version of him smiled and did the same thing. Then they said, "Hiya, y'all." And I knew that here was someone who was going to be easier for the kids to make fun of than me. Most of the kids were just staring. Then Larry Dunn said, "Lord, today, look at the nappy-headed, down-home country cornflake the cat done drugged up from Mississippi, y'all." About a million fingers pointed at the new kids, and a million laughs almost knocked them over. Larry Dunn threw an apple core from the back of the bus, and the new kid got his hand up just in time to block it from hitting him in the face. Little bits of apple exploded all over the kid, his brother, and me. The other kids went wild laughing and saying to each other, "Hiya, y'all!" The bus driver jumped out of his seat and stood between the new kid and Larry Dunn. You see how you kids is? This boy shows some manners and some respect, and y'all want to attack him. That's why none one of y'all is ever going to be nothing." The bus driver was really mad. "Larry Dunn, you better sit your ass down and cut this mess out. I know you don't want to start panning on folks, do you? Not with what I know about your mama." Someone said, "Ooh," and Larry sat down. The bus was real quiet. We'd never seen the driver get this mad before. He pushed the two new kids into the same seat as me and told them, "Don't you pay no mind to them little fools. They ain't happy lest they dragging someone down." Then he had to add, "Y'all just sit next to Poindexter. He don't bother no one." I sat there and looked at them sideways. I didn't say anything to them and they didn't say anything to me. But I was kind of surprised that God would send a saver to me in such raggedy clothes. The world's greatest dinosaur war ever. I couldn't believe it. The door opened in the middle of math class, and the principal pushed the older raggedy kid in. Mrs. Cordell said, "Boys and girls, we have a new student in our class starting today. His name is Rufus Fry. Now I know all of you will help make Rufus feel welcome, won't you?" Someone sniggled. "Good. Rufus, say hello to your new classmates, please." He didn't smile or wave or anything. He just looked down and said real quiet, "Hi." A couple of girls thought he was cute because they said, "Hi, Rufus. Why don't you sit next to Kenny and he can help you catch up with what we're doing?" Mrs. Cordell said. I couldn't believe it. I'd wanted my personal saver to be as far away from me as he could get. I knew when you had two people who were going to get teased a lot and they were close together, people didn't choose one of them to tease, they picked on both of them. And instead of picking on them the normal amount, they picked on them twice as much. Mrs. Cordell pushed the new kid over to the empty seat next to me. Kenny, show Rufus where we are in the book. I watched the new kid sideways. He said, Kenny, I thought they said your name was Poindexter. The class cracked up, part from his country style of talking and part from laughing at me. I could tell that even Mrs. Cordell was fighting not to break out laughing. Though he was looking friendly when he said this, I kind of knew it had to be teasing because who ever heard of anybody's mama giving them a name like Poindexter? When he sat down next to me, I tried to imitate Byron's death stare, but it didn't work because the kid smiled at me real big and said, "My name's Rufus. What are we doing?" Times tables. That's easy. You need some help? No, I said, and scooted around in my chair so all he could do was look at my back. This guy was real desperate for a friend because even though I wouldn't say much back to him, he kept jabbering away at me all through class. When lunchtime came, he followed me outside right to the part of the playground where I sit to eat. He forgot about bringing a lunch, so I gave him one of Mama's throat-choking peanut butter sandwiches and let him eat the last half of my apple. He really was a strange kid. He only ate half the sandwich and folded the rest up in the waxed paper. And when I handed him the apple, he even ate the spots where you could see my teeth had been. He didn't even wipe the slob off first. And man, this kid could really talk. He was yakking a mile a minute, saying stuff like, "Your mama sure can make a good peanut butter sandwich," and "How come these kids is so darn mean?" Then he said something that made me get all funny and nervous inside. He said, "How come your eyes ain't looking in the same way?" I looked to see if maybe this was the start of some teasing, but he looked like he really wanted to know. He wasn't staring at me either. He was kind of looking down and kicking at the dirt with his raggedy shoes. It's a lazy eye. He stopped kicking dirt and said, "Don't it hurt?" "No." He said, "Oh." Then kicked a little more dirt and hollered out, "Oh, boy, look at how fat that there is." "What?" "You don't see that squirrel?" he asked me and pointed up at a tree across the street. "That sure is one fat, dumb squirrel." I looked at the squirrel. It didn't look fat or dumb to me. It was a regular old squirrel sitting on a branch chewing on something. "How come you think it's dumb?" "What kind of squirrel sits out in the open like that with folks all around him? That squirrel wouldn't last 2 seconds in Arkansas. I'd have picked him off easy as nothing." The new kid pointed at the squirrel like his finger was a gun and said, "Bang! Squirrel stew tonight." "You mean you shot a gun before? Ain't you? You mean you really ate a squirrel before? You ain't? A real, real gun? Just a .22. How's a squirrel taste? It tastes real good. You mean you really shoot 'em with real bullets and then you really eat 'em? Why else shoot 'em? Real squirrels, like that one. Well, not that fat and not that stupid. I guess all the fat, stupid ones been got already. Since I've been born, all that's left in Arkansas is skinny, sneaky ones. I think them Michigan squirrels is worth two Arkansas ones." "You aren't lying." He raised his hand and said, "I swear for God. Ask Cody." "Who?" The little shrunk-up version of the new kid was standing by himself up against the fence that runs around Clark, watching us. The new kid waved at him, and his little brother came running over. The big one pointed over at the squirrel. "Cody, look at there." Cody laughed and said, "Oh boy, that sure is a fat squirrel. Think you could pick him off from here?" Cody pointed his finger like it was a gun and said, "Bang, squirrel stew tonight." I couldn't believe this little kid had shot a gun too. "You shot a real gun? Just a 22. With real bullets. The little one looked at his big brother to see why I was asking all this stuff. It seemed like they were trying to be patient with me, like I was a real dummy or something. The older one said, "Tell him." "Yeah, it was real bullets. What else you gonna shoot out a gun?" I still didn't believe them, but the bell rang and lunch was over. I know he didn't think I noticed, but the big kid gave his little brother the other half of my sandwich. I guess both of them had forgot about lunch. This savor stuff wasn't going anything like I thought it was supposed to. Rufus started acting like I was his friend. In the morning, on the bus, he'd always come sit next to me, and Mrs. Cordell put his regular seat next to mine in school. Every day at lunchtime, he followed me out to the playground and ate half of my second sandwich, then sneaked the other half to Cody. He even found out where we lived and started coming over every night around 5:30. I didn't mind him coming over to play, because both our favorite game was playing with the little plastic dinosaurs that I had, and you couldn't really have any fun playing by yourself. That was because someone had to be the American dinosaurs, and someone had to be the Nazi ones. Rufus didn't even mind being the Nazi dinosaurs most of the time, and it was okay playing with him because he didn't cheat and didn't try to steal my plastic monsters. The only other guy I used to play with was L.J. Jones, but I quit playing with him when a lot of my dinosaurs started disappearing. I've got about 1 million of them, but before L.J. started coming over, I had 2 million. It's kind of embarrassing how L.J. got them from me. At first, he'd steal them one or two at a time, and I asked Byron what I should do to stop him. Vi said, "Don't sweat it, punk. The way I figure it, one or two of them stupid little monsters ain't a real high price for you to pay to get someone to play with you." But L.J. wasn't satisfied with doing one or two. I guess he wanted a raise, so one day he said to me, "You know, we should stop having these little fights all the time. We need to have one great big battle." "Yeah. We could call it the world's greatest dinosaur war ever," I said. "But I get to be the Americans." I should have known something was fishy when L.J. said, "Okay, but I get first shot." Most of the time, it always took a big fight to decide who had to be the Nazis. I started setting up my dinosaurs, and L.J. said, "This ain't right. If this really is the world's greatest dinosaur war ever, we need more monsters. You should go get the rest of them." He was right. If this was going to be a famous battle, we needed more fighters. "Okay, I'll be right back," I said. This wasn't going to be easy. I wasn't allowed to take all of my dinosaurs out at once because Mama was afraid I'd lose most of them, especially because she didn't trust L.J. Every time he'd come over, she'd tell me, "You watch out for that boy. He's a little too sneaky for my tastes." I had a plan, though. I'd go upstairs and drop the pillowcase I kept my dinosaurs in out of the window. I wasn't so stupid that I'd drop them down to L.J. I'd drop them out of the other side of the house and then run around to get them. My plan worked perfect. After I went and picked up the pillowcase, I set up my dinosaurs and L.J. set up the Nazis, and we started the battle. He took first shot and killed about 30 of mine with an atomic bomb. My dinosaurs shot back and got 20 of his with a hand grenade. The battle was going great. Dinosaurs were falling right, left, and center. We had a great big pile of dead dinosaurs off to the side and had to keep shaking more and more reinforcements out of the pillowcase. Then, in the middle of one big fight, L.J. said, "Wait a minute, Kenny. There's something we forgot about." I was ready for a trick. I knew L.J. was going to try to get me to go away for a minute so he could steal a bunch of my monsters. I said, "What?" "These dinosaurs been dropping atom bombs on each other. Think about how dangerous that is." "How's it dangerous?" L.J. said, "Look." He made one of his brontosauruses run by the pile of dead dinosaurs, and when it got two steps past them, it started shaking and twitching and fell over on its side, dead as a donut. L.J. flipped him on the dead dinosaur pile. I said, "What happened to him?" "It was the radioactiveness. We gotta bury the dead ones before they infect the rest of the live ones." Maybe it was because we had such a great war going on, and I was kind of nervous about who'd win, but this stupid stuff made sense. So instead of digging each one of the couple hundred dead dinosaurs a grave, we dug one giant hole and buried all the radioactive ones in it. Then we put a big rock on top so no radioactivity could leak out. This really was the world's greatest dinosaur war ever. We fought and killed dinosaurs for such a long time that we had to make two more graves with two more big rocks on top of them. LJ finally pulled the trick I knew he was going to, but he did it so cool that I didn't even see it coming. Kenny, you ever been over in Banky and Larry Dunn's fort? LJ knew I hadn't. Uh-uh. I found out where it is. Where? You want to come see it? Are you crazy? They ain't there. This is Thursday night. They're up at the community center playing ball. Really? Well, if you too scared. I knew this was a worm with a hook in it, but I bit anyway. I'm not scared, if you aren't. Let's go. I figured the trick would come in right here, so I kept a real good eye on LJ while we put my monsters back in the pillowcase. When we were done, I sneaked a look at his back pockets, because I knew when he stole dinosaurs, he put them back there, or in his socks. From the way his pockets were sticking out, it looked like he had one Tyrannosaurus Rex and one Triceratops. I couldn't tell how many he had in his socks. I figured that wasn't too bad a price for as much fun as we'd had. LJ was talking a mile a minute. They even got some books with naked ladies. You ever seen a naked lady? Yeah, lots of times. I had, too. Byron had borrowed lots of nasty magazines from Bubhead's library. I knew LJ didn't believe me, though. For some reason, if you were famous for being smart, no one thought you'd ever looked at a dirty book. LJ said, "You gotta be in the house by 7, don't you?" "Yeah." "Okay. We better hurry before it gets too late." After I'd sneaked the dinosaurs back into the house, we ran off toward Banky and Larry Dunn's secret fort. It wasn't until 9 o'clock at night when I was in bed that a bell went off in my head. I'd forgotten all about the radioactive dinosaurs. I put on my tennis shoes, got my night reading flashlight, climbed out the back window, and went down the tree into the backyard. I got to the battleground and saw the 3 radioactive graves. But when I moved the rock on the first one and dug a little bit down, I didn't hit one dinosaur, not one. The second grave was empty, too. I didn't even move the rock from the third one. I just sat there and felt real stupid. I couldn't help thinking about Sunday school again. I remembered the story about how a bunch of angels came down and rolled away the rock that was in front of Jesus' grave to let him go to heaven. I think it took them 3 days to push the rock far enough so he could squeeze out. My dinosaurs weren't even in their graves for 3 hours before someone rolled their rocks away. Maybe it was a lot easier for a bunch of angels to get 1 million dinosaurs to heaven than it was to get the savor of the whole world there, but I wish they'd given me a couple more hours. But I was just making excuses to myself for being so stupid. I know if a detective had looked at these rocks, he wouldn't have found a clue of a single angel being there. But I'd bet 1 million bucks that he'd have seen that those rocks were covered with a ton of L.J. Jones fingerprints. I never played with LJ again after that, so playing with Rufus got to be okay. It was a lot better not to have to worry about getting stuff stolen when you were with your friends, and it was a lot better not spending half the time arguing about who's going to be the Nazi dinosaurs. I was wrong when I said that me and Rufus being near each other all the time would make people tease both of us twice as much. People started leaving me alone and going right after Rufus. It was easy for them to do because he was kind of like me. He had 2 things wrong with him, too. The first thing wrong with Rufus was the way he talked. After he said that "hiya y'all" stuff on the bus, he got to be famous for it, and no matter how much he tried to talk in a different way, people wouldn't let him forget what he'd said. The other thing wrong with him was